Blog Talk Radio.
This is G for Yourself. Now, here's Gio.
Hi, and welcome to G for Yourself. Glad you're with us today, wherever you happen to be in the world at this moment. Panic. Just the sound of that word makes you feel a little queasy. Panic and anxiety, along with claustrophobia, have been long-time challenges with no real reliable solutions. Our guest today is the originator of a program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. Tom Bunn is a licensed therapist, regular contributor to Psychology Today, and is a former U.S. Air Force captain and commercial airline pilot. Tom is also the author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. Tom, thanks for being with us today.
John, thanks for having me on. I really like the idea of getting the word out because this is going to make a big difference in a lot of people's lives.
It sure will. And you know, before we get directly into the book, I just want to ask you, as someone who flew the Air Force's first supersonic jet fighter, I've interviewed pilots before, jet pilots.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever asked this question. What does it feel like to fly at faster than the speed of sound? What is the sensation? What are your thoughts? What is that like?
It's a big letdown. The day that they told us, okay, you guys are going to go up and go supersonic today. All right, so we went up to, I forgot what altitude, somewhere in the 30,000 foot range, and pushed the throttle all the way up and went to afterburner to get all the thrust we could out of the airplane. And as you get closer and closer to the speed of sound, the wind resistance, the drag, the shockwave builds up, and your acceleration just gets to be almost nothing. And so when you finally get the plane to go through the speed of sound, it's just all academic. You're just looking at a dial that says, okay, you just went Mach 1.001. And you sit there, and it says, now you're going Mach 1.002. Basically boring.
Another day.
Nothing happening when you're just boring a hole in the sky.
Oh, another day at the office. Well, you know, if you are a test pilot, as it were, then
that might be a little terrifying at times.
Yeah,
and doing that kind of work.
And we're talking about panic today. I'm sure you have had some more than routine moments and some scary times.
At flying the F-100, if you weren't afraid, you didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah.
It was a dangerous airplane.
Yeah, yeah. So how does one make that transition from pilot to dealing with people who experience panic? Wow, tell us that story.
It wasn't intentional. What happened was, at Pan Am, we had a captain who had a couple of friends who were afraid of flying, and he worked with them, got them going, and then he set up a fear of flying course sponsored by Pan Am. He asked me to work with him, and I told him I wasn't interested in anybody who was afraid of flying. I figured they were crazy. I didn't want to be around a bunch of crazy people. He says, come on, take a look. You'll be surprised. And I was. It turns out I went to one of his courses as a volunteer to see what it was like, and it was amazing. Everybody there was very intelligent, and they're all very imaginative. Those are the two ingredients that cause people to have trouble when they're flying. You can think of 1,000 things that could go wrong, and you can put every one of them in your mind vividly. That's what causes the stress. And in his course, what we tried to do was help people stay out of panic with breathing exercises. Just wasn't powerful enough. So I suggested we try cognitive behavioral therapy techniques, and we never got that going. So I finally set up my own course and added cognitive. It helped some people, but it still didn't help everybody, because when you get into a state of panic, your cognition goes south on you, and you have very little cognitive ability to apply those tools that we come up with to help people get out of panic. So it appeared we were going to have to come up with something automatic if it was going to work. Jerry Lynn Ross, down in Washington, was also working on something that would work automatic. She came up with thought stopping. Put a rubber band on your wrist. Every time you think of anxiety-producing thoughts, snap it. Cause yourself some pain. Okay, that will work, I guess, but isn't it kind of crude? Maybe we could do something a little bit more sophisticated. So I thought about, what about thought redirection? Every time you think an anxiety-producing thought about flying, let's see if we can train you to shift over to some experience you've had that's kind of a big deal. So I was working with a marathon runner, and I said, every time I give you this hand signal, I want you to go step, 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 take yourself back, relive running the marathon. So I would say, okay, your plane's taxiing out, give her the signal, plane's taking off, give her the signal. So we went through the whole flight, linking all the various things that could trigger her on the flight to running the marathon. She did okay. But I tried the same thing with other people. Didn't work. Then I had a woman who said, I'm going to link it to nursing my child. And I thought, you got to be crazy. You're going to get on the plane and think you're never going to see that kid again. And she called back a week later, perfect flight. And I thought, this is weird. But I dropped it until it happened a couple more times. After a few times where women on their own, because I didn't suggest it, linked it to nursing their child, all of these people had perfect results. So I said, let's see what's going on. There's something here. Sue Carter, who's a big expert in the U.S. about oxytocin, had discovered that when you nurse a child, what nature's trying to do is to keep you from getting anxious, that you should do other things. So you produce oxytocin. Oxytocin shuts the fear system down. So now that we realized that what we were doing was not thought redirection, by doing what we thought was thought redirection, we were just linking being on the plane to nursing. And it wasn't the nursing itself, just the activity. It was the oxytocin being produced by nursing that was doing the job. So now we had something we could really dig into and look for other situations that produce oxytocin. Obviously, that's not going to work for males, but there are some things that will work for males too. So we started linking being on the plane to a memory of a time when you produce oxytocin, so that after you link the various things that are going to happen on the plane to that memory, when you get on the plane, you just keep producing oxytocin every few minutes, keeps the fear system shut down. So that was the first automatic method we had. The second automatic method came from a guy named Stephen Porges, who discovered that when we're with other people, we unconsciously send and receive signals. And the signals from our face, the quality of our voice, and our body language or touch if it's the right person, if they're giving us signals that they're physically and emotionally safe to be with, they calm us. And it happens unconsciously through activation of the parasympathetic nervous system, activating the vagus nerve. Vagus nerve slows the heart rate, slows the breathing rate, relaxes the gut. So we had now two ways to deal with the problem of having panic attacks and anxiety in general on the plane. One was, stop the release of the stress hormones that rev you up and activate the calming system that calms you down. So as it worked out, we were running very high numbers in terms of stopping panic on the airplane, somewhere around 80-85%. And I thought, meanwhile, that on the ground, cognitive behavioral therapy was doing a good job, but I happened to take a look at the stats. Cognitive only stops panic for maybe 17% of the people who get triggered by it. So I figured it's time to do a book on what we had discovered that will work in the plane can work on the ground even easier, because it's not as demanding a situation. You know, I mean, for example, going into an MRI or a tunnel or bridge, high places, that's stressful. But the thing about the airplane, it combines all of them. So if we can stop panic on the airplane, that was the lab we developed this, then it's easy to stop panic on the ground. So that's how this book came about.
When I'm flying, and I know a lot of other people do this too, I like to grab an aisle seat. And I'm wondering, are we really looking for some sort of imaginary escape in case something happens? I mean, is there something to having an aisle seat?
It could be, but also you're giving yourself more visual space when you are in one of those inner seats, particularly the way they cram people into airplanes now. You've just got no physical space and no visual space. At least if you're on the aisle, you can look down the aisle, so you psychologically have
you say that Panic Free picks up where early childhood development was arrested. Would you talk a little bit more about how that happens in childhood?
The interesting thing here is that when we're born, the revving up system is totally mature. Any baby knows how to scream bloody murder and get our attention. But the child has no ability on their own to calm down. They do have a calming system called the parasympathetic nervous system. They have that system. They have the hardware. They don't have software. So for the first year and a half or 2 years, someone else has to calm the baby. Someone else has to activate that system. And the way it's done, now that we know from Porges' research, the way that's done is intuitive, but the way it's done in terms of neurological study is those signals from the mother's face, from the quality of her voice, and from her touch. So the research now shows that if a child is comforted at least half the time when upset, not just slightly comforted, but comforted completely, to the point that they're completely calm, that will produce the security that the child needs to develop a way to ultimately be able to activate the calming system themselves. However, the research shows something that's pretty shocking. It just came out a couple of weeks ago that if a parent frightens a child just once, they don't develop this. Mm-hmm. And that bothers me because I think almost every parent loses it once in a while. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the stats about who's securely attached, about 60%, about 40% not securely attached, I think it's a pretty low bar to say you need to be calmed 50% of the time or better. I think that's easy. But what's not so easy is never losing it with a child and doing something that's scary to the child, like yelling at them or shaking them or for some reason the research mentioned to growling at them. And it also mentioned, and this is something I think that we have seen happen also with kids, is the parent wants the child to follow along and the child's not following, so the parent acts as if they're going to abandon the child, and then the child rushes up. They say that also produces insecure attachment. But what I wanted to get to, in order to develop the ability to calm yourself, you need to have the security of being calmed by a parent for a year and a half or 2 years.
Our guest on this Chief for Yourself is Tom Bunn, author of Panic Free, the 10-day program to end panic, anxiety, and claustrophobia. You gave some mention of meditation in the book, but I think there were conditions to that as to whether meditation can work or maybe isn't so helpful. Can you clarify that?
What I see happening with a lot of people I work with who panic easily on the plane is they don't have a lot of ability to look inward. So ordinarily, when a person is cool, calm, and collected, they're aware whether they are doing, what kind of processing is going on. Is it perception of what's outside, or is it imagination about something that's not outside but could be, or is it memory? We look inward, and we kind of monitor ourselves inside, and we know what kind of processing is going on, so we know whether what we have in mind is real or imaginary. But when a person gets stressed enough, that ability disappears, and whatever's in the mind if it's imagination, it masquerades as reality. What I want to get to is that a person who doesn't do very much looking inward doesn't develop a robust ability to look inward. Yeah. So they are more vulnerable to panic than a person who does more looking inward and develops a robust ability to look inward. It takes more stress for them to lose the ability to tell the difference between what's real and what's imaginary. I mean, even today I was talking with a client who said, I have this feeling that if I get on this plane tomorrow, I'm going to die, I'm going to crash. And what's happening is that the stress of thinking about being on the plane is causing her to lose track between what she has in her mind that's imaginary. It's imaginary that her plane's going to crash, but it seems very real to her because she's not being able to really sense that it's just a thought.
Hmm. Well, speaking of medication, after medication here, the treatment of panic with meds is people will use meds to do that, but there are side effects. You want to talk about some of that effect of medical treatment?
Yeah, and the stats also are kind of disappointing with that. I mentioned 17. Well, it's the numbers are 17% of people treated with CBT become panic free, but when you add CBT and meds, it gets to around 35 or 36. That's still not great. And meds are controversial because they're pretty addictive, and you have to take pretty high doses of them to control panic.
Yeah. Now that's when I dealt with anxiety attacks. Now that's not panic, but I dealt with anxiety attacks. I went to a doctor, and he gave me tranquilizers. I went through that whole thing, and I used breathing and all of that. But as I said, anxiety and panic are different. So if you would explain those differences.
Yeah, I think what happens that's the difference is that you can be anxious about something, but you still have some idea that it might happen, it might not happen. When you get into a state of panic, you are convinced that you're in a life-threatening situation or in a situation where great harm could happen. That's the first item. The second item is you can't escape. There's no way out. Mm-hmm. So you put the two together, life-threatening situation and trapped. That's the prescription for panic. And what often happens, we tend to think of panic as being hyperarousal, and it may start out as hyperarousal, being highly revved up, but then you can have this bounce-back effect where you go hypoaroused, and you go into a state of immobilization, as Stephen Porges puts it, or what we see in animals that play dead. We can have a bounce-back so that our heart rate goes way down, and our breathing rate goes way down, and we become like a deer in the headlights and can't act. Mm-hmm. I'll give an example. I remember some years ago, I went with a girlfriend to Italy. We went to Venice, and there's a basilica there where you can go up into the balcony and then go out from the back of the balcony onto a huge terrace that overlooks the whole city, and you're about 30 feet in above the city. It's, I think, just a very dramatic sight. I walked out there with her, and she started to panic. I didn't realize that she was subject to panic, but she said, she just started yelling at me, get me out of here, get me out of here. And I thought, wait a minute, we are out. What she meant was, get me back inside. But the thing that I wanted to point out is she had just walked through the door to come out there. She should have known where the door was. She could go back, but she couldn't do it. She told me to get her back through that door. When people panic, the ability to act can just go completely south on you.
Mm-hmm. I recall that what you just said was included in some of those points from I was checking out airsafe.com, and you may have fear of flying if there was a list of them. And one of them was the fear of heights, and another was you don't like being around strangers. I thought that was interesting because today so more and more people are living alone. They're avoiding people, and I'm wondering, can they just induce a kind of fear of flying or panic by having that lifestyle?
Well, yeah, if a person doesn't develop that ability to automatically calm down, we were talking about a few minutes ago, if you can't automatically calm down, what you want to do is to not get revved up, so you want to control everything. So you don't want any surprises. And the amygdala, the part of the brain that releases stress hormones, it will release stress hormones any time it senses something that you're not used to or something surprising. Well, if you're around strangers, you're not used to them. You'll get stress hormones released when you're around strangers. However, ordinarily, when the stress hormones hit you and you kind of wakes you up and you look at the person, you may intellectually say, well, they look okay. But what I think is more interesting is what Stephen Porges came up with, that if you start talking with the person, and you start picking up these unconscious signals that are passed between people, you'll become calmer by the signals that they're sending you that they're safe to be with. I mean, everybody knows that dogs sniff each other out to determine whether they're going to be friendly or fight or whatever. And we sniff each other out, according to Porges' research, with the person's eyes, what we see there, what we hear in the quality of their voice and in their body language. And it's not just intellectual. In fact, he says that the signals that matter are not something we can consciously perceive, but they do have an effect on calming us if the signals indicate safety.
You say that we don't rise, I think it was rise to the occasion, but rather under stress we descend to the level of our training. Can you discuss that?
Yeah, well, it's the same kind of thing we were just talking about in a state of panic. You lose the ability to use good thinking. All you can do in a state of panic is something you have practiced. If you think about people who do high stress jobs, they may not get to the level of panic, but they get stressed enough that their conscious mind, their logic, their rational thinking is not at its best. So what people do who do high stress jobs, life and death situations, people who work in emergency rooms, doctors there or technicians or firemen or policemen, you go through training where you have a procedure for the various things that you would expect to run into. And they're canned. There's step one, step two, step three, and so on. And you do them repeatedly to build them into what's called unconscious procedural memory. Now, the benefit of unconscious procedural memory is it's huge to start with, but it's also in the subcortex, which is not bothered by stress hormones. So when your cortex, your high-level thinking, stops operating very well, if you trained your unconscious procedural memory to do a task, then it can kick in. So that's why that phrase comes. You don't necessarily rise to the occasion by becoming more intelligent, because your intelligence is kind of going south on you. Yeah. But what you can depend on is what you have practiced again and again and again in training. And just to kind of give people an understanding of what unconscious procedural memory is, when they drive their car, they could have a conversation with someone. Unconscious procedural memory is doing the driving.
It's pretty much a cliche to say that you're in much more danger driving your automobile than you are on a flight. And flight safety really has come a long way. They're doing great things,
yeah.
Aren't they? Now,
yeah,
I mean, it's very safe.
When I went to work at Pan Am, it's 1965, and at that point, there was an accident of a major airline in the U.S. every year. In fact, Pan Am usually had their own. We used to say, you know, if you know the slogan for Pan Am, the world's most experienced airline. So we used to say, Pan Am, the world's most experienced airline, reports another experience, because we flew in some pretty dangerous places. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of accidents.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, about 1977, 78, somewhere in there, we had a whole year in the U.S. where there were no major accidents. I thought, wow, this is amazing. Imagine a whole year with no crashes. Look at us now. We've gone for 17 years without major crashes in the U.S.
Yeah.
Now, people don't necessarily know that, because there's crashes other places in the world. They get a lot of press, and people say planes are crashing all the time. Not here, because here we do the aviation right. And a lot of places, they don't do aviation right. And just to throw in something that may be of interest to people about the 737 MAX, there's nothing wrong with the plane.
Hmm.
It was operated by airlines where the pilots, so-called pilots, are not real pilots. They are not trained. They don't even... The procedure that would have taken care of the malfunction the MAX had is a procedure that every Boeing pilot in the U.S. memorized. I learned it back in 1965. The procedure hasn't changed. It's very simple. I could fix that problem in 3 seconds, but they didn't even know the procedure. They were supposed to memorize it. They didn't even know it existed.
Are they cutting corners, those airlines?
More than cutting corners.
Yeah.
Far more than cutting corners. There was a time, I'm told, that when Lion Air at one point did not pay
play. Not where you want to see that. No. I'm wondering, do airlines refer the so-called white-knuckle flyers to you? It seems like it would be a good idea for them to send you people or to at least let your service be known. Do you work in cooperation with the airlines to...
Southwest sometimes sends people to us. We approach the other airlines, but the only airline that was helpful in that regard was Southwest. Here we had this lab at 30,000 feet where we were helping people deal with fear of flying. The main thing they were worried about, not the plane crashing so much, but crashing psychologically. And we stopped panic there. And so it's a piece of cake to stop it on the ground. So that's why it's easy to do it in just a week or 10 days. Therefore, that's the title of the book, Panic-Free, the 10-Day Plan to End Panic, Claustrophobia, and Anxiety.
And the website is panicfree.net?
Yep.
The book is Panic Free, the 10-Day Program to End Panic, Anxiety, and Claustrophobia, from our guest Tom Bunn. Tom, thanks for writing this book and dedicating your efforts to easing the fears of so many people. You're always welcome to come back and talk with us again sometime, and I hope you'll do that.
Thanks for having me on.
I'll get a link to Tom Bunn's website onto the page at chieforyourself.com. Stay up to date with upcoming topics and guests when you subscribe to Genulines. The blog posts you'll get will give you that information and lots of other great content, too. Just put your email address into the box at the top of the chieforyourself.com start page or at the top of the Genulines page, and you'll get all the information you need to know. The number of subscribers to Chief for Yourself has been increasing steadily, and I want you to know that I'm very appreciative of that fact. Whether you're a new arrival or you've been with us through the years, your presence here and your attention are always welcome. The same goes for those of you supporting and following Chief for Yourself on Facebook and Twitter. So, that being said, I will thank you again for being with us and for all of your support. Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.